Welcome to the Story Night podcast, where you hear true stories on a theme, recorded live on stage and without notes. I'm your host, Jessica Holmes. This week we hear two stories from our September 2010 theme, White Lies, Stories of Polite Fiction, that both focus on deceptions and distinctly Western worksites. Featured storyteller Holland Williams first tells the Ballad of Harold, the king of white lies and blast powder in the forests of Washington.
Hi, I'm Holland. This is about 10 years earlier, Aberdeen, Washington in the 1970s. Anybody been to Aberdeen, Washington? Aberdeen's most famous resident was a resident, Kurt Cobain, founding member of Nirvana, was in elementary school then. At the time, Aberdeen is a pretty gritty town. It rains 100 inches a year of rain, and it's still not enough to wash it clean. I had moved there from New York City, so it was a big culture shock. I was working north of Aberdeen, about halfway between Forks and Hump Tulips, working as a logger, setting chokers on the high lead side. And I'd been there about a month, and the camp boss, after work, came up and asked me if I wanted to work as a powderman's helper on the construction side. And, you know, when you're 22 years old and somebody's offering you $12 an hour to blow things up, it's kind of like, you know, pretty exciting. I didn't want to seem too excited, so I just kind of, yeah, I'll do that. And so he told me, 6 o'clock in the morning, Crummy will pick you up. On the ride home, I asked one of my guys I'd worked on the rigging with about it, and he said, you get to work with Weird Harold. I asked him, can you expand on that a little bit? He said, no, you'll find out. It was a little after 6 when the Crummy pulls up. They call them Crummies because that's basically what they were. They were usually 6-passenger pickups or 8-passenger vans. And you could take one off auto showroom floor and put it out in the woods for a week, and it was a disaster. You know, they were filthy, dinged up, streaked with tobacco juice. I mean, they were basically what the logging crews drove back and forth to town in. So I'm waiting out there. The Crummy shows up, and there's this guy, and he just has a look of aggression. I mean, he's about 6'2", 260 pounds, big, thick head and oversized arms. He just kind of looks me up and down and says, you better not be a cull, or we'll run your ass off. No, I'm okay. So I got in, and we took off. We were working south of Aberdeen in near South Bend. And they were doing repair work on the road, and they closed it, and he pulled in right behind the pilot car, and he looked around a little bit, and there's a flagger there, and he pulls out in front of the pilot car and yells at the guy, get out of the road! Took off through the construction zone. We're bouncing along, dodging dump trucks, and after about a quarter, half a mile, there's the foreman waving his arms, and he just flipped them off and banked around the closed sign and out, and away he went. That was my introduction to Harold. We were working, out of South Bend. It was up in the hills, about 10 miles inland from the ocean, and it was mostly all, it had been logged at the turn of the century, and by now, in the 70s, it was 2.5-3 foot in diameter, hemlock, but no roads, so we were building roads in there so the logging crews could come in and log. My job, working with the powdermen, was to go ahead the right of way, and we would load, you know, blow anything up that was going to be an impediment to the cat. It was fun, except for Harold. I mean, made my life hell. He didn't have very much. He wasn't much in the way of social graces, but he was kind of a savant when it came to running equipment. I mean, this guy could make a caterpillar do anything. So it was entertaining to watch. But when the cat wasn't running, he was usually riding my butt. I came walking out. He'd holler at me, go run over there, get those two logs down below there. So I charged down there right into a big patch of Devil's Club. And the Devil's Club is that really spiny. I spent the whole afternoon picking them out of my skin. And he was just over there chortling away. He thought that was the funniest thing. A couple days later, he hands me this oversized wrench and said, go pull the drain plug. Yeah, by now, I'd pretty much figured, well, there's got to be something to this. He said, that's just like changing the oil in your car. Just pull the plug. Well, it was like changing the car, only about 20 gallons more than in a car. And I whacked my head on the belly pan and got drenched in about 20 gallons of oil. That kept him going for a while. It didn't take long to realize that there was a reason why he was working down away from everybody else. He was a storyteller. He was a bullshitter. Usually, some epic road-building episode or killing a huge elk or a giant sturgeon or something like that. But he was also, kind of one of those guys. I remember a quote from Steinfeld. I think it was George that said, well, it's not a lie if you really believe it. Yeah. Well, for Harold, it wasn't a lie if there was some advantage that came back to him from telling it. So he had kind of a running, I guess you'd call it, disinformation campaign, going on with Foreman. The Foreman had worked with Harold, so knew him pretty well. And he was pretty careful about what kind of information he would share. Because if Harold would quickly take advantage of anything he knew. He knew the rigging crew had to come in 2 days later, well, he'd just slow way down and it would he'd be working over, time and a half on Saturday and double time on Sunday to finish everything up. So he managed things pretty shrewdly. In time, it got a little easier for me, but it was still, he was kind of one of those guys you always had to be kind of watching out. One day, the foreman was there and asked us if we wanted to work that next Saturday, and, Harold was, no, I got to work, I made plans to go sturgeon fishing. About an hour later, he comes to me and says, you want to work tomorrow? And by then I knew, what he would say one minute was completely contradictory to what he might say the next minute. So I said, yeah, sure. Got up the next morning and drove to the site, and there's a tractor and a lowboy from another logging company there. So we loaded up the cat, drove 7 miles down the road, and built about a half-mile road landings and spur roads for this other company. Came back, brought the cat back to our job site. Harold had a whole pocket full of $100 bills, and he peeled a couple off to me. And this happened a couple of times. And one of the things there were days when Harold would just sit there. He wouldn't even fire up the cat. And then there'd be a flurry of activity for about 2 hours, and he'd, get a whole day's work done in 2 hours. And one of the things I noticed when the foreman would come down, he'd kind of surreptitiously kind of look at the hour meter on the cat. They have, unlike an odometer on a car that measures miles, the hour meter on the heavy equipment, tells the number of hours it's running. So I realized then he was just very carefully managing the hours on the meter on the cat. So, he had to take time off if he wanted to use the cat on other jobs. So. And about this time, they had made me the powderman, and so now I had to go back and forth you know, I'd work for Harold for a couple of days, and then I'd go up to one of the other sites and work there. And, you know, it was, Harold would be requesting me now, and, you know, I was just kind of baffled, you know. This guy that just would harass me, now all of a sudden he wanted me around. That was about the time he got religion. Nothing else changed. He was still the same person. But he was going to church every Sunday. And he started bugging me to go with him. And, you know, I finally said, okay, I'll go once. Don't ask me again. I'll go once. He said, yeah, okay. We went to church. That was something else. I mean, I grew up in the Unitarian Church. You know, you sit in the chair, you listen, you know, you get up to sing, and you sit down and you listen. This church was something else. I mean, they were yelling and screaming and hollering, and, you know, he was right there in the center with the biggest voice. He was also driving the Sunday school bus. So, I didn't spend my weekends in Aberdeen. I usually left. And one day Harold collared me, and he said, you got a town every weekend. Can I borrow your house? All right. I wasn't going to ask any questions. I didn't want to know. So I gave him a key. And this goes on for, a couple of months. And Harold's having an affair with his bus captain. Then he starts coming over in the middle of the week. And I'm going, Harold, you're going to get caught. He says, no, I'm too smart. Well, I'm sitting out there reading a book, and a knock on the door. There's Harold's wife. And I let her in, and I said, is Harold here? Well, it was kind of obvious. There's trucks parked out in front, you know. Harold, your wife's here. And there's a slam, crash, bang, and, you know, about 30 seconds later, out comes Harold. And it's the first time I've ever seen him kind of at a loss for words. And he's, what do you want? And she's kind of looking at him. She says, where is she? I don't know what you're talking about. Would you mind if I take a look around? Yeah, go right ahead. She walks in, she looks around the kitchen and back to the back bedroom. She opens the door, turns the light on. She didn't see that his girlfriend that was holding her breath behind the door. Walks back out. Well, when you coming home? She says, a couple hours, hour or so. Turns to walk around. There's a woman's purse right by the door. They both saw it about the same time, but she had a step on him. She grabbed it. He grabbed the strap. There's a tug of war. She ends up with the purse. They're staring at it, at each other for a minute. It was just like a stop motion kind of in a film. He turns to her and says, are you going to believe me or are you going to believe your lying eyes? She just stood. It was like she was struck by lightning. She just stood there, just kind of, she couldn't stay. There was just, you know, it was just, and I'm sitting there going, oh, my God. Well, she turned, walked out the door. Next day, Harold and his girlfriend rented an apartment together. Lasted about a week. Then Harold moved back home. He lived out in his shop in a cot, on a cot, for about a month. I think if there was an apology, it would be something like, well, she just took control over me. I'm sorry. Another few weeks, he moved back into the house, onto the sofa. And after about another month, it was as if nothing had ever happened. Thank you.
Love stories? Sign up for our email feed to get the story lowdown every Monday. We'll give you a peek into the week's podcast, upcoming events, submission deadlines, and more. Just visit storystorynight.org and enter your email at the right. Now, let's hear from story slammer Hobie Swan, a somewhat seasonal chef serving up white lies and more on a fishing boat in Alaska.
I have to say, I really didn't think lightning would strike twice. I got picked for the first one last time, so here I am again. Okay. So in about 1975, I'd moved to Seattle, and I moved into one of those group homes that were, group home, is that what they're called? I was sharing a house with a bunch of people. And and one of the women I was living with had a boyfriend in Dutch Harbor, Alaska. And he had a big freezer that he was going to hollow out and turn into a cafe, because it was so cold up there, you had to have walls this thick. So that was he was this Irish guy, and that was his get-rich-quick scheme. Can you give me a little help here? He was going to sell seagull omelets out of this reconditioned. And so he had this whole big plan, he was going to do this, and then he found out that it was illegal to take seagull eggs. Anyway, so she got me a free ride up to Alaska, and Dutch Harbor is just the most desolate place you can imagine. It's up in the Aleutian Islands, and so I just went up there, and I was going to work in a salmon cannery, or excuse me, a king crab cannery, and just process the crab that came in off of these boats that were going out into this horrific weather. And, the Bering Sea in the winter, it's 20-foot waves, 100-mile-an-hour winds. You work 24 hours a day catching the crab because you got to get all the crab you can while you're on the crab, right? So, but that didn't matter to me because I was going to be in the processing ship on the shore, so who cares, right? I met this guy named Thierry who was from France, and he had been a chef in France. And so one day it turned out that one of the crab boat cooks had gotten sick, and they'd heard about this guy Thierry, and so they wanted to know if he would be a cook on the crab boat. And so he was thinking about it, and he asked me to be his interpreter because I spoke fluent French. He spoke perfectly good English. And I never really understood. In retrospect, I don't know why he asked me to go with him, but he wanted me to go with him as the interpreter. So we went out to this, we're out in this dock, and the wind's blowing like crazy, and there's this giant boat there. And the captain comes down, and he says to Thierry, so, would you like to come out on the boat and be our cook for 2 weeks until this other guy, hopefully recovers? And Thierry says, no. And the captain looks at me and says, how about you? Do you know how to cook? And my white lie was, I said, yeah. Yeah, I know how to cook. Because I'd had a vegetarian restaurant where we cooked like quiches and, stuff like that. And it didn't really occur to me that I'd be on this boat out in the middle of nowhere with these five fishermen who were, they were like meat eaters. And I think I was still pretty much a vegetarian at that point. And it didn't even cross my mind. And then next thing I knew, I'm getting on this boat, and we're going out into these oceans, and I'm on one of these boats now, And, this was like an 80-foot-long crab boat. And the waves were so high that we'd get up to the top of a wave, and both ends of the boat would stick out, and you could hear the propeller whining because there wasn't any water there. And I would have to work a regular crew shift, and then when all the crew went in and laid down and drank coffee and stuff, I'd go in the kitchen and I would try to figure out how in God's name to cook for these people, And I remember the first thing I cooked was like a roast, and I somewhere learned to sprinkle, luckily they had onion soup mix. So I sprinkled that on the roast, and then I baked it, and that came out pretty good. And then they were satisfied. And then like the next night, I'm digging around, and I didn't buy any of the food. It was already bought. It was already on the boat. And so I'm like digging around, like these animal parts. I didn't really know anything about. And there was this one that looked like a basketball. And I was like, okay, basketball. So I picked this thing up, and it's about this round, and it's a brisket. And it was this big, a frozen brisket of beef. And I didn't even know what it was. And luckily, it had printed on the instructions how to cook it. And has anybody cooked anything like this? I didn't even know if it was cookable, because I took the plastic wrapping off of it, and it said to boil it for 5 hours. So, you know, I got, you know, we're all out fishing and everything. And so I put this thing in the water. And, you know, after about 4 hours, again, and I check and I take a knife and it's just like doing, doing, doing. And I go, okay, well, maybe the weather, the, I don't know, the motion or something. So I come back after 5 hours, 6 hours, 7 hours. And by this time, I put it in really early so it'll be ready for dinner. And dinner rolls around and it is not done. I mean, it is just this round, rubbery ball of cow or something. And I was so pissed off that I just remember I took it out of the thing and I had my oven mitts on. I picked it up and I went out to the back of the boat and I just went and I kicked it off the end of the boat. And all the other guys, they looked at me like, "Oh, what are we going to eat now?" And luckily there was an Aleut Indian on the boat, and he in the pots we'd get all this weird stuff, including a lot of halibut. So he like deep fried a halibut, and I thought it was like best fish I'd ever eaten. But all the fishermen were like totally pissed off because like, what's the last thing you want to eat when you're on a fishing boat is fish. So I don't even know. I don't even know how I muddled through other meals. I really can't think of what I ate, but it was really cool because like one night I was in the kitchen working and I was facing the counter and I was cutting something up and I looked around and all these birds, the little auklets, are about this big. They look like little penguins kind of. They were coming into the galley. And you look around, and I have to do my work, right? And I'm cooking. I look around, and these birds keep coming in, and pretty soon, the birds were all over our table, all over the back of the wraparound sort of like upholstered thing we had, and they're all just sort of like, you know, going like this, and they're perfectly happy just to be sitting there, watching me cook or whatever, and then at one point. They all just kind of walked out again, and they flew away. And so I did that. You know, I did that for 2 weeks. And when we got back into the dock, they said, like, bye. And I took my $16,000 and went home.
Thanks for listening. Story Story Night is brought to you by presenting partners the Boise State Story Initiative and The Cabin, venue partner The Linen Building, design partner Neighborhood All-Stars, and our broadcast partner, Boise State Public Radio, who makes this podcast possible. Please donate now at radio.boisestate.edu. Our Story Story Night theme is by Dan Costello. Hear more at hearcostello.com. Please join us on the podcast next week for more White Lies, Stories of Polite Fiction. And join us on October 25th in person for Spooked, Stories of the Uncanny. Learn more at storystorynight.org.